Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Lost Voice edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, anarchy and science. Oligarchy and wealth. Child poverty in the USA. And Marx and economics. Let's begin episode 332.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker. I am Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week you may have noticed my voice is, well, not my own. I seem to have lost my voice this week, and taking a page from Stephen Hawking, I am using an artificial voice this week. Let us pause for a second and contemplate what I just said. I am talking to you, but sans the physical use of my own vocal system? Sure, if you really were Stephen Hawking, you might have the luxury of this tech, but for most, this is a very recent development. And another thing, having played with systems like this for decades, the actual quality of the voice is quite good. If you were only half listening, something I know my loyal fans never do, you might be hard-pressed to know it was artificial. Also, to provide my listeners a dose of philosophy, how do you know where the artificial part ends and where the real me, the Don, begins? By that, you only the voice's word that what it is saying are my, or Don's words, they might not be, how would you know? It is possible that all these years, Stephen Hawking was just the puppet of some AI that is the real source of his genius, and we've never known that because, well, all of Stephen's communication is mediated through his artificial voice, I'm just saying, and praise be to our new silicone overlords, ha ha ha. But getting back to the show, I did not want to subject you to the vagaries of the uncanny valley with this faux voice, so we are presenting an impromptu web wisdom show this week. Let us start off with a clip from the Idea Channel, where they pose the question, is Rick from Rick and Morty the ideal scientist? Let's listen in.
Here's an idea. Rick from Rick and Morty is the ideal scientist. Rick and Morty is an Adult Swim show about drunken, belching scientist grandfather Rick Sanchez and his nervous, squeaky-voiced grandson Morty Smith. Rick is, by all accounts, an amazingly talented scientist, able to do nothing short of bend time and space, travel to alternate dimensions, enter into the dreams of others, give dogs super intelligence, combine the DNA of Hitler and Lincoln. Okay, we're gonna talk more about that in a second. Morty is what you might expect from a nervous teenager. Worried, reasonably unwilling, and pulled in a million different directions by the various authorities in his life. His parents, Jerry and Beth, his older sister, Summer, his grandfather, Rick, and of course, his own ideas of what he can or should do, what is good and right. Which, I mean, depending upon your worldview, creating a Rudolph Linkler, virulent love potions, or stealing intergalactic cable might not factor strictly under good and right. There's a lot of tension between Morty and Rick about the antics that they get up to. Those antics are almost exclusively things which can be, and are, accomplished because of Rick's incredible scientific talents. And so we may be led to ask, what does Rick think science is for? Apparently, it's for accomplishing whatever personal task, morally sound or not, has recently presented itself to the usually drunk, maniacally self-important generally shouting scientist. Ollie from Philosophy Tube sees this as an argument against scientism, the kind of vague, no questions asked celebration of science as the only harbinger of progress and understanding. Rick, not asking if he should, only if he can, is constantly putting his smarts where his mouth is and constantly bringing absolute anarchy to the Smith's front door.
There's only supposed to be six people in this house.
However, it might also be arguable the degree to which Rick is even a scientist. He totally eschews the scientific method itself. Instead of making observations, asking questions, formulating hypotheses, making predictions, testing against those predictions, gathering data, and developing theories which then feed back into the process, Rick just goes ahead and injects Morty into the body of a homeless man.
Okay, well, I can't cure death. This is bad, Morty. You're trapped in a dead man.
Rick is a shoot-from-the-hip, results-now, questions-later kind of scientist. His scientific process, if he even has one, is as anarchic as its results. We might quite rightfully say that Rick is an inventor or a mad genius and not a scientist in the strictest sense of the word. The show, however, clearly paints him as a scientist, so we'll consider him on his own terms, terms which might be closer to the way science actually works than we tend to think or want to admit, and terms which also sort of align with philosopher Paul Feyerabend's thoughts on science and the scientific method. Wubba lubba dub dub.
Yeah!
There is no idea, however ancient or absurd, that is not capable of improving our knowledge, Feyerabend writes. This is the basic starting premise of his book, Against Method. Modern science, especially how it's taught, and the scientific method, he argues, dismisses too many ideas out of hand. It gives none fair shakes to concepts which do not fit neatly within its boundaries. Feyerabend talks about how scientists are expected to specialize, to consider their pursuit's future more than its history, and are encouraged to treat intersections with other pursuits like art, ethics, or philosophy as icing on the cake rather than structurally integral cake material. His imagination is restrained, he writes about an imagined scientist, and even his language ceases to be his own. This is again reflected in the nature of scientific facts, which are experienced as being independent of opinion, belief, and cultural background, end quote. Which Feyerabend and most philosophers of science would argue is basically an impossible thing. Science comes packaged with culture as much as any other pursuit does. Rick, by comparison, wears the effects of his culture, morals, and biases on his sleeve. He is blatant about it. Why are other scientists normally encouraged to hide these things? Well, lots of reasons. Science discourse has a pretty good corner on the "we are talking about truth here" market. For better or worse, as both a pursuit and an industry, science derives lots of important and necessary power and authority from that discourse. Now, just to be perfectly clear, I am not saying that science is complete hokum. I am only pointing out its popularity when we talk about how we create knowledge. That should be very non-controversial. Many people think of science as something humans do, but not something humans sway or control. Humanity is, it's not opposite, but it's kind of parallel to science. Human-centric stuff is something else entirely, namely the humanities. Feyerabend sees this division, amongst other things, as silly and overly restrictive. It denies the inconsistent mess of scientific progress's actuality, and most importantly, is literally anti-humanitarian. He proposes an alternative to the scientific method. Anarchism. Anarchism, he writes, while not the most attractive political philosophy, is certainly excellent medicine for epistemology and for the philosophy of science, end quote. His suggested method is one where anything goes, any and every form of inquiry, including but not limited to the scientific method, attempting to develop knowledge all at once, all methods smashing into one another, some methods and modes of inquiry working counter to one another, but all of it seen as equally constructing knowledge. This is connected, it's argued, to the long history of important scientific breakthroughs made only because very smart people willingly, knowingly, and repeatedly ignored the social and scientific dogmas of their times. It is, I think, pretty arguable that this could describe Rick. Unconcerned with expectations or conventions, he abandons much of the process of a science in his own pursuit of, well, I guess that's a little up for debate.
Look around you, Morty. Do you really think this world is real?
Though science aims to be a singular, consistent process wherever it is practiced, it really varies wildly in application and aim. A totally dispassionate and objective ideal of science across all of its instances is a great thing to aim for, but in modernity might be a little out of reach. Science, like everything else, can't totally escape the grasp of politics, culture, ideology, or economics, and so it's unlikely, if not a little impossible, that all science is created equal and completely free from influence. So maybe we should just confront this and move on. Maybe that's exactly what Rick does.
My new catchphrase is, I don't give a f-.
Rick postures as though he is singularly focused on science, but he works at the fringes of it. His science is a personal one, which is augmented by countless other lines of inquiry. His process collides with morality, identity, and responsibility, the limits of perception and family, the effectiveness of art, even video games and romance. To describe his method as anything goes feels very accurate. Rick doesn't seem to care about the search for truth. His process isn't about progress or knowledge, but about experience. This is what Firebend is ultimately getting at when he talks about wanting science and the search for knowledge to be humanitarian. Though it would be very fair to question whether Rick's method is humanitarian. It could really go either way. Rick exudes self-importance and disinterestedness. Rick and Morty as a show charts some bleak and iniquitous territory involving the deaths of innocent people, moral fungibility, and the grim price of whatever happiness is. But it is arguable, as Film Crit Hulk does, that Rick and Morty has a kind of, quote, underlying humanity. That as a piece of entertainment, Rick and Morty might make its audience very uncomfortable, but really that's because it's forcing us to stare certain very human things, things about ourselves and our culture, right in the face.
Nobody exists on purpose. Nobody belongs anywhere. Everybody's gonna die.
It may, in its own admittedly very bizarre way, ask us to be compassionate or humane. So if Rick's methods aren't necessarily humanitarian in his world, maybe they are in ours?
Okay, well, sometimes science is more art than science, Morty. A lot of people don't get that.
Interesting, anarchic scientism. Well, the format of Idea Channel is to do a follow-up show based on comments from listeners, so let's follow up by listening to comment responses. Is Rick from Rick and Morty the ideal scientist?
In last week's episode, we talked about Rick and Morty, the pursuit of knowledge, and Paul Feyerabend's idea of an anarchic scientific method. Let's see what you had to say. Obisom Animations, thank you so much for the kind words. I'm glad that you enjoyed last week's episode, and you were not alone in your concern that anarchy was somewhat misrepresented. Paul Feyerabend does, in some ways, unfairly conflate anything goes and this idea of anarchism, which both of which are ideas that factor heavily into against method, where maybe he shouldn't, because, you know, anarchism isn't, strictly speaking, anything goes. It's a lack of recognition of authority. And I think really what he's trying to get at is that we tend to give this idea of method within science authority. And he's asking whether or not that method, as we tend to understand it, should have the authority it does. And that's what he means when he says anything goes. Bill BB writes a really great comment about how in last week's episode there was maybe some conflation between science and scientists, that while science seems to be this nice kind of holistic body of work uncovering truths or knowledge about the world, what scientists engage in is actually far messier and more anarchic than it is usually given credit. And so to say that scientists should adopt a more anarchic process is to kind of just encourage them to continue doing what they do. This, I think, is very much related to another set of concerns raised by Renato E. and a few other people, saying that science, as it is currently practiced, is no longer really claiming to uncover objective truths about the universe, that really it's about creating verifiable sets of knowledge that are perfectly willing to be disproven by future work, and that insofar as Paul Feyerabend talks about science uncovering knowledge that is true in some way, that's maybe an old-fashioned idea. And I think that this is a great point, and I think that it's totally true, and I think that really what we're talking about is the popular idea of science, that when people who are not necessarily scientists are talking about science, they are more likely to talk about it as though it is creating knowledge and it is uncovering truths. Or conversely, if real knowledge or true knowledge does exist, people will tend to think that that knowledge was created by science. And what Paul Feyerabend is saying, like, whoa, 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 I don't know, like, maybe knowledge and truth, whatever we think of those things as being, are just as likely to be made by other pursuits. Professor Politics writes a comment about how Rick might not be the ideal scientist, but together Rick and Morty might create an ideal scientist, that for all of the cynicism and ethical transgression that Rick gets himself involved in, Morty is someone who cares and is curious and wants things to be right, and that the two of them together form a great narrative foil and in the process might actually create a kind of ideal, curious, questioning, and capable scientist. And I think this is a great point.
We will return after this break.
Ever had a hankering to ski the world-famous slopes of Whistler? Boy, do we have great news for you. Escape the city in one of Zipcar's many mountain-ready vehicles. Plus, get $30 back in free driving credit when you tweet a selfie on the slopes at Zipcar Vancouver. Zipcar. Wheels when you want them.
You are listening to Radio Free Thinker on 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada, a truly artificial intelligence-driven radio broadcast. And we are back. So, shifting gears a little, our next bit of web wisdom is an interview on The Bill Moyers Show with Paul Krugman. They are talking about Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty. Using the Piketty's analysis, they discuss the return of oligarchy and the diminishing middle class. They also talk about what the 1% don't want you to know and the decoupling of capital production and wealth accumulation. Let's listen in.
Even in this age of hyperlinks and cyberspace, nearly six centuries after Gutenberg devised his printing press, it's still possible for a single book to shake the foundations, rattle cliches, upend dogma, unnerve ideologues, and arm everyday people with the knowledge they need to fight back against the predatory powers that have robbed them of their birthright as citizens. This is such a book, Capital in the 21st Century, by the French economist Thomas Piketty, the book of the season to many, to others, the book of the decade. Reviewers have called it a bulldozer of a book, magisterial, seminal, definitive, a watershed. At 700 pages, it's already a bestseller. And there isn't a single scene of seduction, not one celebrity interview, not one picture. Just graph after graph, fact on fact, drawn from two centuries of data and embedded in prose that can suddenly explode like a supernova in the brain. Here's one of its extraordinary insights. We are heading into a future dominated by inherited wealth as capital concentrates in fewer and fewer hands, giving the very rich ever greater power over politics, government, and society. Patrimonial capitalism is the name for it, and it has potentially terrifying consequences for democracy. For those who work for a living, the level of inequality in the U.S., writes Piketty, is probably higher than in any other society at any time in the past, anywhere in the world. Over three decades, between 1977 and 2007, 60% of our national income went to the richest 1% of Americans. No wonder this is the one book the 1% doesn't want the other 99% to read. Paul Krugman has been writing extensively and generously about Piketty's book. Welcome back.
Hi.
Inequality has been on the table for a long time. You've written extensively. Others have too. I mean, it's a familiar issue. But what explains that this book has now become a phenomenon?
Actually, a lot of what we know about inequality actually comes from him, because he's been an invisible presence behind a lot. So when you talk about the 1%, you're actually, to a large extent, reflecting his prior work. But what he's really done now is he said, even those of you who talk about the 1%, you don't really get what's going on. You are living in the past. You're living in the 80s. You think that Gordon Gekko is the future. And Gordon Gekko is a bad guy. He's a predator, but he's a self-made predator. And right now, what we're really talking about is we're talking about Gordon Gekko's son or daughter. We're talking about inherited wealth playing an ever-growing role. So he's telling us that we are on the road not just to a highly unequal society, but to a society of an oligarchy, a society of inherited wealth, patrimonial capitalism. And he does it with enormous amount of documentation, and it's a revelation. I mean, even for someone like me, it's a revelation.
I was going to ask, what does Paul Krugman have to learn from this book?
Even the title, the first word in the title, capital, we stopped talking about capital. Even people like me stopped talking about capital because we thought it was all about human capital. We thought it was all about earnings. We thought that the wealthy were people who one way or another found a way to make a lot of money.
Right.
And we knew that that wasn't always true. We knew that in the Gilded Age or in the Belle Epoque in Europe, which he prefers to talk about, that high incomes were mostly the result of having lots and lots of assets. But we sort of said, well, that's not the way things work anymore. And he says, oh, yeah? It turns out that you're wrong, that it's true that right now a lot of high incomes in America are people who didn't start out all that rich, but we're rapidly moving towards a state where inherited wealth dominates. I didn't know that. I should have known it. I should have thought about it, but I didn't. And so then here comes this book with, I mean, it's beautiful. It happens to be analytically beautiful, if that makes any sense at all.
Yes, as you know, I'm no economist, but I found this book, as I said in the opening, just very readable, and suddenly there'd be this moment of epiphany.
Yeah, it's a real eureka book. You suddenly say, oh, this is not, the world is not the way I saw it. The world, in fact, has moved on a long way in the last 25 years and not in a direction you're going to like, because we are seeing not only great disparities in income and wealth, but we're seeing them get entrenched. We're seeing them become inequalities that will be transferred across generations. We are becoming very much the kind of society we imagine we're nothing like.
Here's Piketty's main point. Capital tends to produce real returns of 4 to 5%, and economic growth is much slower. What's the practical result of that?
What that means is that if you have a large fortune, suppose that our family has a large fortune, the inheritors of that large fortune can live very, very well. They can live extraordinary standard of living and still put a large fraction of the income from that fortune aside, and the fortune will grow faster than the economy. So the big dynastic fortunes tend to take an ever-growing share of total national wealth. So when you have a situation where the returns on capital are pretty high and the growth rate of the economy is not that high, you have a situation in which not only can people live well off inherited wealth, but they can actually pass on to the next generation even more, an even higher share. So it's all, in his terms, R, the rate of return on capital, and G, the rate of growth of the economy. And when you have a high R, low G economy, which is what we now have, then you're talking about a situation in which dynasties come increasingly to dominate the top of the economic spectrum, and a tiny fraction of the population ends up very dominant.
What's the realistic impact of this on working people?
There's a direct impact, which is that part of income is always going to go to labor, although that seems to be a diminishing fraction, but the part that comes from capital is going to be in the hands of a very few people. The other thing, which I think is critically important, and he talks about more towards the end of the book, is the political economy. That when you have, that's what Teddy Roosevelt could have told you and did, that when you have a few people who are so wealthy that they can effectively buy the political system is going to tend to serve their interests. And that is going to reinforce this shift of income and wealth towards the top.
I was taken with something you wrote the other day. You said that, in your opinion, the real problem is not capital accumulation per se as much as it is, quote, remarkably high compensation and incomes. Now, how does that differ from what you were just saying about wealth that passes to the next generation?
So right now, high incomes are still primarily coming from people who've made a lot of money, typically as corporate executives. That has been the story. So the big expansion of inequality in the United States since the 1970s has so far been driven by high salaries, high bonuses, and all so on. That's where we are now, but looking forward, he's telling us that the story is already changing, and it's going to change more. So we are going, probably, unless something gets better, we're going to look back nostalgically on the early 21st century, when you could still at least have the pretense that the wealthy actually earned their wealth. And, you know, by the year 2030, it'll all be inherited.
And at the same time, we can't even manage to pay work as a minimum wage of $10.10.
Yeah, and what's amazing, I thought actually one of the most depressing things, although enlightening in his book, is he talks about France in the Belle Epoque, the years before World War I, which was ideologically as much a society committed to equality in principle as we are today, but in practice was totally dominated by very wealthy families, where it was impossible to even raise the possibility of seriously taxing great wealth, where it was very hard to do anything to improve the conditions of ordinary workers. And it shows you how that can happen, how you can have a society where even though the ideology is democratic, even though we claim that all men are equal, in practice, not a chance.
Isn't that what's happening now in this
country? Exactly. Exactly. That's the point. And what's funny is at the time, Americans used to say, oh, we should never allow ourselves to become like old Europe. And in fact, we have.
You remind us often, and you did so just the other day, that the United States has a much more unequal distribution of income than other advanced countries, and that much of this difference comes from government actions, such as?
If you look at, well, look at European countries, just about all of them, they don't actually necessarily have higher taxes on very high incomes. That's not so much the factor. And they have higher taxes overall, which are used to pay for a lot of programs of aid. So you have universal health care, right, and we have sort of are stumbling our way towards something like that now. But they have a lot of income support for people with low incomes. They have lots of support for young parents. They have lots of, basically, a lot of redistribution, which is a dirty word in U.S. politics, but in fact is essential to having a decent society, so that to be the average American is richer than the average person in France, although that's mostly because we work longer hours, but to be in the bottom of the bottom fifth in France is a far, far better thing than to be in the bottom fifth in the United States because of these government policies. It's not that wages are especially high at the bottom in France, a little bit higher than in the United States because they have a high minimum wage, but mostly you have government programs which make an enormous difference. The level of inequality of market income, what people actually make, is not that different among advanced countries. The level of inequality of disposable income, once the government has gotten through taxing and spending, is much, much higher in the U.S. than it is in most other advanced countries, and that's because of the government.
Well, why is, as you said, redistribution such a noxious word in our political system?
I think mostly it's just because there's a very effective apparatus that of TV and print media and think tanks and so on who hammer against any suggestion of redistribution. It just, they've managed to convince a lot of people that it is somehow un-American, which actually, if you look at American history, that's not at all true, but it's just been pushed very hard. As I think also in the United States, look, we have to admit it, that race is always lurking under almost everything in American life. And redistribution in the minds of a lot of people means taking money from people like me and giving it to people who don't look like me. And I think that is a big difference between us and Europe.
You do know that conservatives are regularly, consistently saying that inequality doesn't matter, that if the very rich were less rich, it wouldn't really make a difference to people out there working for a living.
But of course, what Europeans do, which is to tax the rich and use it to provide benefits to people lower down the scale, that makes a big difference. That can make an enormous difference.
You can
take a few percent of national income, take it away from that top 1% and direct it towards the bottom 20%, that's a tremendous gain in the quality of life of the bottom 20%. So just think about, actually, we have a health reform. It's not the health reform we would have wanted, but it's better than no reform. It's financed in large part with small surtaxes on high incomes. That's if you actually ask where the money's coming from, a lot of it is coming from an additional tax on investment income, an additional tax on earned income for very high earners. That is going to give basically everybody in America the guarantee of being able to have essential basic health insurance at an affordable cost. That's a huge change in people's lives, which is being financed in large part by taking a little bit from the top. So a little bit of Robin Hoodism does a lot. You could do a lot more than that. So no one is talking about just, you know, let's punish the rich for the sake of punishing them, but the question is, can you do redistribution in a way that makes us a better society? And the answer is yes.
Well, at the end of his book, Piketty is talking about a global tax on wealth. Do you think that's feasible?
Well, is it feasible politically? You know, if the United States were behind it, lots of things would become possible. If the United States were to support this, then I think you could pretty much guarantee that the Europeans would, enough Europeans would be willing to go along. And while there would be some countries that would, you know, rogue countries that would want to serve as havens for tax evasion, that we would have a lot of leverage over them. So really, it's not that the international global system makes this impossible. It's the U.S. political system that makes it look impossible right now, and that can change.
But given the dysfunction of Congress, given the fact that the Supreme Court has in effect decided to enable corporations and the rich to consolidate their hold on our political system, do you have any hope of the kind of change that both Piketty and you would advocate?
I think you don't give up hope on these things. We have, look at the American political tradition. Look at one of the interesting things that Piketty says is that serious progressive taxation of high incomes and great wealth is an American invention. We invented it, and we invented it in the early 20th century, right at the peak of our Gilded Age, and somehow we found it in ourselves to turn, to find political leaders, people like Teddy Roosevelt, who are willing to say, this is a bad thing. We do not want the society that is emerging here. So I think things can change. What if you ask, you know, are we going to get a wealth tax, a global wealth tax before the 2016 election? Well, no, we're not. Might we get one by the 2024 election? Possibly.
You wrote something the other day that's hard to forget. You said we live in such an ugliness in America right now.
Yeah. This is one of the things that puzzles me, actually, about my own country, which is it's one thing to have disparities of income and wealth and to have differing views about what we should be doing about it, but there is a level of harshness in our debate, mostly coming from the people who are actually doing very well. So, you know, we've had a parade of billionaires whining that about being, you know, the incredible injustice that people are actually criticizing them, and then comparing anyone who criticizes them to the Nazis. You know, it's almost a tic that they have. This is very strange, and it's kind of scary because, you know, it's one thing if someone without a lot of power seems to be going off and into a rage for no good reason, but these are people who have a lot of influence because of the amount of money they control.
Given what you've just said, and given the fact that there's this ugliness, what do you think it's going to take? A mass uprising? Consistent demonstrations? Insurgent politics? How are we going to stem the tide that he says is taking us into oligarchy?
There's a negative and there's a positive take. Piketty seems to argue for much of the book that we only escaped from the old oligarchy for a while thanks to really disastrous events, thanks to wars and depressions, right, which disrupted the system. That's an argument you can make. On the other hand, if you read histories of the New Deal, you know that it didn't spring out of nowhere, that we had a progressive movement and a lot of proto-New Deal programs building for quite a long time. There was, in fact, a move in America. There was an increasing political, philosophical readiness to take on inequality of wealth and power long before FDR moved into the White House. And so I think there are better angels of our nature, that there is this ugliness which can be frightening, but there is also a redemptive streak in here and in other places, and that you don't give up hope on this, that given consistent argumentation, given events, and perhaps, you know, as people become more aware of what is actually going on, then there is a chance of changing things. Do we know that? No, but there's nothing in what we know now that says that you should give up hope of being able to change this even without catastrophe.
On that note, let's grab a quick coffee while we can afford it. We'll be back after this.
When you purchase the latest TV, tablet, or smartphone, don't forget to do the right thing with your old ones. Recycle them. The Consumer Electronics Association and its members are making recycling your old devices as easy as buying new ones. Just go to greenergadgets.org, type in your zip code, and you'll instantly find the recycling location closest to your home. You'll also find recycling tips, like asking the store where you buy your new TV if they'll haul away your old one. Don't let your old tech tools clog your local landfill. Just visit greenergadgets.org.
You are listening to Radio Free Thinker on 101.9 FM from the People's Republic of Social Democratic Skepticism. And we are back. To set up our last bit of wisdom, in this penumbral clip we are going to hear from Professor Richard Wolff from Economic Update, where he looks at an international comparison of child poverty and what it tells us about who is getting it right and why we might want to emulate them. Let's listen in and learn.
I want to also report on another document released this last week. This one by the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Very well-known organization. It includes 34 countries, basically the more industrialized, higher-income countries around the world. It was founded in 1961 and is an enormously important resource for all kinds of economic documents that everybody makes use of all the time. Anyway, they released a report this last week pertaining to poverty levels among the member nations, the 34 member nations. So I thought I would tell you, since we've just finished talking about extreme wealth, what it is that we can say about poverty. And of course, this is poverty among the 34 most developed nations in the world. And you all know which ones they are. I thought some of the results were arresting, and I wanted to tell you about them. The country with the largest amount of poverty, that is, the percent of people living below the poverty line in each country, out of the 34, the country with the largest amount of poverty is Israel. Let me let that sink in. Child poverty, the percentage of children aged 0 to 17 living in poverty, number one. 28.5% of children living in poverty, that honor goes to Israel. I don't know the details, but my guess is we're looking here at the consequences of Israel being two societies in one Jewish and one Palestinian. And we can all think about what that means. Coming in number fifth, is the United States. The countries that have more poverty than the United States are Turkey, Mexico, and Spain. The countries that have less poverty than the United States include Greece, Italy, Japan, France, Netherlands, Switzerland, Ireland, United Kingdom, Germany, and Denmark. Bernie Sanders has been mocked and criticized for making references to Denmark. Well, the numbers on poverty suggest why Denmark may have attracted Mr. Sanders' interest. Let's begin with child poverty, in many ways the most important measure, since what you do to your children, what you condemn them to live in and to grow up in, will affect not only them, but your own society for decades to come. It is in many ways the most. So take a moment with me to look at global child poverty rates in perspective. OECD report, Israel, as I told you, was first. 28.5% of its children live in poverty. By contrast, the United States, 20.5%. Over one out of five American children lives below the poverty line. More than one in four in Israel does. What about Denmark? Are they up there with the 28.5% for Israel and the 20.5% for the United States? No, they're not even close. In Denmark, the percentage of children living below the poverty line is 3.8%. Again, Israel, 28.5%. Denmark, 3.8%. Of course, you would want to look at Denmark and try to understand what they've done, how they did it, and what you can learn. Or, of course, alternatively, you can come up with a breezy dismissal that Denmark is different from the United States, which it surely is, and therefore there's nothing to learn, nothing to worry about, no comparison to draw lessons from. But if you do that, you're not thinking, and you're evading, and you ought to be called out about it. I could go on, but I really want to let this fundamental message sink in. An economic system that produces this kind of inequality inside societies across the globe is not excused by saying that some of the poorest in the world have a better income and diet than they used to. Sure, some of them do. The passage of time has done that. If capitalism wants to claim credit for what it did, okay. But then it has to also accept the gap between what it did and what it could have done. The millions, the hundreds of millions whose lives could have been drastically improved if we just took a little from those who have way more than they need. No morality of any major religion endorses, tolerates, condones what is going on. And that, sooner or later, will come into play.
Very interesting. From next to last, to our actual last bit of web wisdom, this is a talk given by Chris Hedges at the Left Forum last year. Hedges is an author of about a dozen books. He won a Pulitzer Prize while working as a reporter for the New York Times. He has won many other awards and accolades as a reporter, columnist, and author. He is currently a reporter at large for publications like Truth Dig. The title of his talk is Marx, The System is the Problem. Let's listen in.
Karl Marx exposed the peculiar dynamics of capitalism, or what he called the bourgeois mode of production. He foresaw that capitalism had built within it the seeds of its own destruction. He knew that reigning ideologies, think neoliberalism, the free market, were created to serve the interests of the elites, and in particular, the economic elites.
And God.
Since the class which had the means of material production at its disposal has control at the same time over the means of mental production. And the ruling ideas are nothing more than the ideal expression of the dominant material relationships, the relationships which make one class the ruling one. He saw that there would come a day when capitalism would exhaust its potential and collapse. He did not know when that day would come. Marx, as Megan Desai wrote, was an astronomer of history, not an astrologer. Marx was keenly aware of capitalism's ability to innovate and adapt, but he also knew that capitalist expansion was not eternally sustainable. And as we witness the denouement of capitalism and the disintegration of globalism, Karl Marx is vindicated as capitalism's most prescient and important critic. In a preface to the Contribution to the Critique of Political Economy, Marx wrote, "No social order ever disappears before all the productive forces for which there is room in it have been developed. And the new higher relations of production never appear before the material conditions of their existence have matured in the womb of the framework of the old society itself. Therefore, mankind always sets itself only such tasks as it can solve. Since looking at the matter more closely, we always find that the task itself arises only when the material conditions necessary for its solution are already exist, or at least are in the process of formation. Socialism, in other words, would not be possible until capitalism had exhausted its potential for further development. That the end is coming is hard now to dispute, although we would be foolish to predict when this would happen. And for this reason, we are called to study Marx very closely. The final stages of capitalism, Marx wrote, would be marked by developments that are intimately familiar to us. Unable to expand and generate profits at past levels, the capitalist system would begin to consume the structures that sustained it. It would prey upon, in the name of austerity, the working class and the poor, driving them ever deeper into debt and poverty, and diminishing the capacity of the state to serve the needs of ordinary citizens. It would, as it has, increasingly relocate jobs, including both manufacturing and professional positions, to countries with cheap pools of labor. Industries would mechanize the workplaces. This would trigger an economic assault on not only the working class, but the middle class, the bulwark of a capitalist system that would be disguised by the imposition of massive personal debt as incomes declined or remained stagnant. Politics would, in the late stages of capitalism, become utterly subordinate to economics, leading to political parties hollowed out of any real political content and abjectly subservient to the dictates and money of global capital. But as Marx warned, there is a limit to an economy built on scaffolding of debt and expansion. There comes a moment, Marx knew, when there would be no new markets available and no new pools of people who could take on more debt. And this is what happened with the subprime mortgage crisis. Once the banks cannot conjure up new subprime borrowers, the scheme falls apart and the system crashes. Capitalist oligarchs, meanwhile, hoard huge sums of wealth, $18 trillion stashed in overseas tax havens, exacted as tribute from those they dominate in debt and impoverish. Capitalism would, in the end, Marx said, turn on the so-called free market, along with the values and traditions it claims to defend. It would, in its final stages, pillage the systems and structures that make capitalism possible. It would resort, as it caused widespread suffering, to harsher forms of repression. It would attempt, in a frantic last stand, to maintain its profits by looting and pillaging state institutions, contradicting its own stated nature. Marx warned that in the later stages of capitalism, huge corporations would exercise a monopoly on global markets. The need of a constantly expanding market for its product chases the bourgeoisie over the entire surface of the globe, he wrote. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere. These corporations, whether in the banking sector, the agriculture and food industries, the arms industries, the communications industries, use their power by seizing the mechanisms of state to prevent anyone from challenging their monopoly. They fix prices to maximize profit. And they push through trade deals, think of the TPP and CAFTA, to further weaken the nation state's ability to impede exploitation by imposing environmental regulations or monitoring and controlling working conditions. And in the end, these corporate monoliths obliterate free market capitalism itself. A May 22nd editorial in the New York Times gives us a window into what Marx said would characterize the late stage of capitalism. I quote from the Times. As of this week, Citicorp, J.P. Morgan, Chase, Barclays, and Royal Bank of Scotland are felons, having pleaded guilty on Wednesday to criminal charges of conspiring to rig the value of the world's currencies. According to the Justice Department, the lengthy and lucrative conspiracy enabled the banks to pad their profits without regard to fairness, the law, or the public good. The Times goes on. The banks will pay fines totaling about $9 billion, assessed by the Justice Department as well as state, federal, and foreign regulators. That seems like a sweet deal for a scam that lasted for at least 5 years, from the end of 2007 to the beginning of 2013, during which the bank's revenue from foreign exchange was some $85 billion. The final stages of what we call capitalism, Marx understood, is not capitalism at all. Corporations gobble down government expenditures, in essence taxpayer money, like pigs at a trough. The arms industry, with its official $612 billion defense authorization bill, which ignores numerous other military expenditures tucked away in other budgets, rising our real expenditures on national security to over $1 trillion a year, has gotten the government this year to commit to spending $348 billion over the next decade to modernize our nuclear weapons and build 12 new Ohio-class nuclear submarines estimated at $8 billion apiece. Exactly how these two massive arms programs are supposed to address what we are told is the greatest threat of our time, the war on terror, is a mystery. After all, as far as I know, ISIS does not own a rowboat. We spend $100 billion a year on intelligence. It's a black figure, so we're guessing, and read surveillance, and 70% of that money goes to private contractors, corporations like Bose, Allen, Hamilton, which gets 99% of its revenue from the U.S. government. And on top of this, of course, we are the largest exporter of arms in the world. The fossil fuel industry swallows up $5.3 trillion a year in worldwide hidden costs to keep burning fossil fuels, according to the IMF. This money, the IMF noted, is in addition to the $492 billion in direct subsidies offered by governments around the world through write-offs, write-downs, and land use loopholes. In a sane world, these subsidies would be invested to free us from the deadly effects of carbon emissions caused by fossil fuels, but we do not live in a sane world. Bloomberg News, in the 2013 article, Why Should Taxpayers Give Big Banks $83 Billion a Year, reported that economists had determined that government subsidies lower the big banks' borrowing costs by about 0.8%. Multiplied by the total liabilities of the 10 largest U.S. banks by assets, the report said, it amounts to a taxpayer subsidy of $83 billion a year. I quote from the Bloomberg article. The top five banks, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Citicorp, Wells Fargo, and Goldman Sachs, the report read, account for $64 billion of the total subsidy, an amount roughly equal to their typical annual profits. In other words, the banks, occupying the commanding heights of the U.S. financial industry with almost $9 trillion in assets, more than half the size of the U.S. economy, would just about break even in the absence of corporate welfare. In large part, the profits they report are essentially transfers from taxpayers to their shareholders, end quote. Government expenditure accounts for 41% of GDP. Corporate capitalists intend to seize this money, hence the privatization of whole parts of the military, the push to privatize Social Security, the contracting of corporations, as I mentioned before, to collect intelligence for our 16 intelligence agencies, the privatization of prisons, schools, and our disastrous for-profit healthcare system. None of these seizures of basic services make these services more efficient, nor do they reduce the costs. But that is not the point. It is about feeding off the carcass of the state, and it ensures the disintegration of the structures that sustain capitalism itself. All of this Marx got. Marx illuminated these contradictions within capitalism. He understood that the idea of capitalism, free trade, free markets, individualism, innovation, self-development, work only in the utopian mind of a true believer such as Alan Greenspan, never in reality. The hoarding of wealth by a tiny capitalist elite, Marx foresaw, along with the exploitation of workers, meant that the masses could no longer buy the products that propelled capitalism forward. Wealth increasingly becomes concentrated in the hands of a tiny elite, and this is how the world's richest 1% are now on track this year to have more than half of the world's wealth. The assault on the working class has been going on for several decades. Salaries have declined or remained stagnant since the 1970s. Manufacturing has been shipped overseas, where workers in countries like China or Bangladesh earn 22 cents an hour. The working poor, forced to compete with the labor of those who are little better than serfs in the global marketplace, proliferate across the American landscape, struggling to live at a subsistence level. Industries such as construction, which once provided well-paying, unionized jobs, are now the domain of the non-unionized, often undocumented workers. And corporations import foreign engineers and software specialists to do professional work at one-third of the normal salary on H-1B, L-1, and other work visas. All these workers are bereft of the rights of citizens. The capitalists respond to the collapse of their domestic economies, which they engineered, by becoming global loan sharks and speculators. They lend money at exorbitant interest rates to the working class, to the poor, even if they know that money can never be repaid, because then they can sell it in bundled debts, credit default swaps, bonds, and stocks back to us through our pension funds, to cities, to investment firms, and to institutions. This late form of capitalism is built on what Marx called fictitious capital, and it leads, as Marx knew, to the vaporization of money. Once subprime borrowers began to default, as these big banks and investment firms knew was inevitable, the global crash of 2008 took place. The government bailed out the banks, largely by printing money, but left the poor and the working class, the victims, with crippling personal debt. Austerity became policy. The victims of financial fraud were paid for the fraud. And what saved us from a full-blown depression was, in a tactic Marx would have found ironic, massive state intervention in the economy, including the nationalization of huge corporations such as AIG and General Motors. What we saw in 2008 was the enactment of a welfare state for the rich, a kind of state socialism for the financial elites, and Marx predicted it all. But with this comes an increased and volatile cycle of boom and bust, bringing the system closer to disintegration and collapse. And we have undergone two major stock market crashes and the implosion of real estate prices in just the first decade of the 21st century. The corporations that own the media have worked overtime to sell a bewildered public the fiction that we are enjoying a recovery. Employment figures through a variety of gimmicks, including erasing those who are employed for over a year from unemployment rolls, are a lie, as is nearly every other financial indicator pumped out for public consumption. We live rather in the twilight stages of global capitalism, which may be surprisingly more resilient than we expect, but which is ultimately terminal. Marx knew that once the market mechanism becomes the sole determining factor for the fate of a nation, as well as the natural world, both will be demolished. No one knows when this will happen, but that it will happen, perhaps within our lifetime, seems certain. The old is dying. The new struggles to be born. And in the interregnum, there are many morbid symptoms, Antonio Gramsci wrote. What comes next is up to us. Thank you.
And on that note, let me remind my listeners that what comes next is up to you, up to me, up to all of us. As individuals, we lack power, the system is rigged against us, and resistance, by the individual, is often token at best. But there is one power they cannot take away from us, by definition will always be a part of us, and that is our numbers. We are not the 99% because of some abstraction, we are the 99% because we are the 99% of the people. The feet that march, the voices that call out for change, the hands that can take the status quo and break it, the minds that can see a better world and build it. We have the power, we'll always have the power. What we lack, what we must discover within each and every one of us, is the will to wield that power, and with luck, and rational critical thinking, we will also have the wisdom, when the time comes, and it will come, to wield that power to make a better, more equitable world, a world where all humanity prospers and not just the 1%. That is all the time we have this week. This is Don, or at least we are assuming it's me, saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.